From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, the world seems more violent than ever. Is it really as bad as it seems?
You don't hear about all the parts in the world where civil wars have fizzled out and have not restarted.
Also, Margaret Atwood becomes my analyst.
How old are you?
I'm 44.
Oh, do you feel trapped by anything yet?
And Tim Heidecker and Eric Wareheim are known for their disturbing brand of absurdist comedy. But their new series doesn't exactly aim for the funny bone.
Most of life is a nightmare.
Like, we're tired of trying to make people laugh with our humor. We want to make people cry.
Yeah.
And Jason Moran shows the modernity of Fats Waller. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. All the recent news about wars, not just in Syria and Iraq, but in Ukraine, Gaza, and elsewhere, probably has you wondering, are things as bad as they seem? Have they ever been this bad? Steven Pinker is a psychologist who spent a lot of time and energy researching the history of human violence, quantifying our rates of killing each other over the millennia. He laid out his findings in a nearly 800-page book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. And to skip right to the end, he says we're living in the most peaceful time in human history. But that book came out 3 years ago. I asked Pinker, given the more recent situations worldwide, if anything about his findings had changed.
The major trends of violence have continued to decline, not to reverse. Homicide is down worldwide, and it's important to remember that homicide kills about five times as many people as wars. More countries and states have abolished capital punishment. Rates of child abuse are down. Rates of rape are down. Rates of domestic violence are down. And when I say down, I mean down now compared to 4 years ago, let alone the preceding decades, which saw even greater declines. Now, there's only one category in which the rate of violence has gone up, and that's rate of deaths in war, which has crept up a bit because of Syria. But remember that since news is about the stuff that happens, it's not about the stuff that doesn't happen, you don't hear about all the parts in the world where civil wars have fizzled out and have not restarted. And that's why even with the horrors of Syria, the death rate in war has not gone up by very much. If I could just mention some numbers, during World War II, for example, the rate of death in war was about 300 per 100,000 per year. During the Korean War, it was in the 20s. During the Vietnam War, in the teens. During the 80s and 90s, it was in the single digits. In the 2000s, it fell to less than one. Now it's crept up to a tiny bit more than one. That means that it's still a 300th of the rate during World War II and a 25th of the rate during the Korean War.
Stephen, do you have faith that violence will continue on this downward trend? Or what is there to prevent humanity from falling back into a cycle of violence?
Well, how likely is it that we're going to start throwing virgins into volcanoes to get good weather, or that you're going to have a return of slave markets to New Orleans? I think pretty unlikely. So I don't have faith in any of these trends, but I think that there are a number of them that are very likely to continue. I don't think the country is going to put up with the high rates of violence that it tolerated in the 60s and 70s. We now know how to bring it down, and we're not going to backslide. I don't think there's going to be a return of great power war. I mean, a lot of what you're seeing in Ukraine is the result of the fact that not even the most hawkish of American hawks are proposing that we fight Russia on the battlefield like great powers did prior to World War I. On the other hand, there are certain categories of violence that are quite unpredictable, and here I would not be willing to predict that the trends would necessarily continue. Civil wars are a lot harder to control than wars between countries. There are only about 200 countries in the world, and that's a small number of actors to decide that war is a stupid way to resolve disputes. On the other hand, in a world of 7 billion people, there's no end to the number of popular liberation fronts that could pop up, get their hands on lots of semi-automatic weapons, and create mayhem in some local part of the world. Likewise, I don't think that terrorism is going to vanish because, again, in a world of 7 billion people, it's very easy for some disaffected 25-year-old men to decide to raise hell and get a lot of attention to this or that cause. So it very much depends on the category of violence.
That's Steven Pinker, author and professor of psychology at Harvard. Steven, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The video showing the murder of British aid worker David Haines has triggered new outrage across the world. Stills from the video are appearing on news broadcasts and websites, recharging an old debate. When is it appropriate to show such images when reporting a story? Is it ever appropriate? Kelly McBride is a media ethicist at the Poynter Institute. When we spoke earlier today, she was in transit at an airport in Cleveland. I asked her about the ethical hazards news organizations face when using images provided by terrorist groups, like the so-called Islamic State.
It's a really hard decision for news directors and news editors to make. These images and these videos are meant to be propaganda. They're meant to spread fear and terror. And when you do that, when you use these images, if you don't use them in the appropriate tone, you really are going to just play right into their hands. So I don't counsel people to never, ever use the images, but I try and tell them to pay very close attention to how they're using them, to make sure that they tell their audience how the images were obtained and what they were meant to be used for. And then I also try and tell them to add other context to the images. So, for instance, if you're showing an individual who's about to be executed, if you show other photos of that individual where he's not being held as a prisoner, it changes the tone of the coverage completely.
A lot of news organizations, including our own website, have been using photo stills from the video. Is that a problem?
You know, I think when you use them to try and tease the audience into the stories, I do think that those can be a little inflammatory. And I think, you know, even if you use a photo from the video and then another photo, if you splice it together, it has a different impact.
Clearly, groups like ISIS understand how Western media operate and want to use us to amplify their message. What's the newsroom conversation you like to hear when that dilemma comes up?
You know, what I want to hear people talking about is, can they use the photo in a way that conveys that ISIS is, yes, a terrorist organization, but how do you help the audience understand more about ISIS? ISIS spends a lot of time trying to make people afraid of them. How many people are in ISIS? How well funded are they? Where are they located? By adding all of that information, you tend to give the audience more than just, gosh, they're beheading Westerners, we should be afraid of them. And so giving more information often takes the power away from ISIS and puts it in the hands of the news organization or of the people who are trying to respond to ISIS.
In cases where there's a hostage situation, there's always a concern with news organizations that you're going to be a mouthpiece for the hostage takers. Is that something that applies in cases like this?
Yes, it definitely does. And most news organizations that have worked in an international arena have a lot of information about how to minimize the harm to hostages. And a lot of that they keep in the background. But most news organizations are paying attention to that information. And if they're not, they should be. And so if you're an editor or a producer in a news organization that hasn't been privy to those conversations, you just need to get with somebody who has.
Kelly McBride is the Vice President for Academic Programs at the Poynter Institute. Kelly, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's hard to imagine a living writer more accomplished than Margaret Atwood. Novels, poems, short stories, children's books, essays, and works that defy classification. She's distinguished herself in every possible way. Margaret Atwood is somehow able to write fantastic tales that are deeply literary and infused with a brilliant sense of humor. At 74 years old, her wit is as sharp as ever.
When you're writing fiction, everybody thinks you're secretly writing about real people and things. But if you write an autobiography, they think you're lying, as one does.
Atwood's latest book is a collection of wonderfully weird short stories. When we spoke, I asked her to read part of the title story, Stone Mattress. I'll just set it up. There's an older woman who's gone on a cruise, and she happens by chance to encounter the man who had raped her when she was a young woman.
And he doesn't recognize her.
Yes.
But she recognizes him. The next morning, during the chartered flight north to where the ship is floating on the Beaufort Sea, she considers her choices. She could play Bob like a fish right up to the final moment, then leave him cold with his pants around his ankles. A satisfaction, but a minor one. She could avoid him throughout the trip and leave the equation where it's been for the past 50-some years, unresolved. Or she could kill him.
And she goes for option three.
It's kind of set up in the first sentence of the story where it says, at the outset, she didn't intend to kill anyone. So you think, well, that was at the outset.
It's interesting about these characters. It's really striking about all of them is how they're in the later part of their lives, but they're really still so deeply affected by what happened in their youth.
And you will be too. Yes, it does seem to be a human characteristic that, in fact, those things, although you may forget about them in your 20s, they are the sublayer upon which your life is based, and they come back.
You know, although not many of us get the chance to address them so intimately or in the case of this character, violently.
You'd be surprised.
You have a character in this book. It's from the first three stories in this collection. They're interconnected. And in the first story, you have an aging writer who has created this fantasy world. And it's kind of B-literature, sort of by her own reckoning, this place called Alfenland. But it becomes more real to her, more important to her over time.
Well, it becomes more real to her and more important to her because it's an escape from her actual life. And talk to any writer on that subject. But she starts her series for pulp magazines back in the early 60s before any of this kind of writing had a cachet. So think of a world without Comic-Con. You know, it didn't exist back then. And people wrote these things for the pulps under different names because you didn't want to have the same writer all the time.
No, I wouldn't want to be in a world without Comic-Con necessarily, but at the same time...
You wouldn't want... Let's examine that. You wouldn't want to be in a world without Comic-Con. That's a pretty firm commitment.
It is. I'll stand by that.
Well, I would not want to be in a world in which people didn't dress up from time to time.
Right.
It would be very boring.
Right. Is there, you know, this character Constance in Alfenland? I just wonder, reading about her in this world that she's created, is it a fear for a writer like yourself who has done so much writing that in a way you become trapped by what you've created?
How old are you?
I'm 44.
Oh, do you feel trapped by anything yet?
I feel trapped by a lot of things.
Are any of them of your own creation?
Well, that's kind of deep.
It is. It's quite deep, isn't it? Yes. Well, that was the question you asked me.
Yeah, I would. But I'm supposed to ask the questions. I'm not supposed to reflect on myself.
There are no rules. In Alfenland, we make up our own rules. Okay, let's put it another way. In Alfenland, Constance has got a couple of other people trapped in there.
Yes.
For instance, she's got her old boyfriend in a barrel in a disused wine facility. And she's got her old rival for that very boyfriend shut up in a stone wall and attacked by bees. So she's acting out, but in a way that doesn't actually harm the real people, or so we believe.
I read that you're working on a book that won't be read for 100 years, intentionally, something that's called the Future Library Project.
Isn't that good? So I was approached by the Norwegian Library of the Future. It's called Future Library. They're building the building, the new library, and in that new library there's going to be a room, and they're growing a forest in Norway, and it will grow for 100 years. Does this recall Sleeping Beauty to your mind? And each one of those 100 years they will invite one writer to write a manuscript. It can be anything. It can be a novel, a poem, nonfiction, and all that can be told about it is its title. So each one of those 100 years, the manuscript will be presented and put into this room in the library in a box, sealed, like a genie in a bottle. And at the end of the 100 years, they will cut enough trees from the forest to make enough paper to print the book of these books, of all of the manuscripts that have been put in the boxes.
So you agree to do this, so obviously there's something about this you find attractive, or at least intriguing.
There's a number of very attractive things about it. First of all, I will not have to deal with the critics. Think of that. Second, it is a lot like the message in the bottle metaphor for writing any book. So any book that you write it, and then you publish it. That's the bottle part. And it goes out on the sea of wherever books go. It flows hither and thither, and you don't know who may read it. So this is the same, except that there's a 100-year gap. As the writer, you will never know what people think of it. You will also never know whether they understand it, because the language may have changed in that time. Being a practical person, I did think immediately, I will have to get archival paper and non-fade ink, or else they might open the box and find nothing in it.
That's Margaret Atwood. Her new book of short stories is called Stone Mattress. Margaret, great fun speaking with you. Thank you.
Lovely speaking with you.
Not a single doubt that everything is in full swing when you hear someone shout. It is. The George is jumping. It's really jumping. Coming, cats, and check your hats. I mean, this George is jumping.
Legend has it that pianist Fats Waller used to say, if you don't know what it is, don't mess with it. Well, fellow pianist Jason Moran knows what it is, and he is messing with it.
This joint is jumping. It's really jumping. Come on, cats, and check your hats. I mean, this joint is jumping.
Jason Moran's latest album is called All Rise, a joyful elegy for Fats Waller. He's taken some of Waller's biggest crowd pleasers and reworked them to reveal just how timeless these songs are. Moran was originally commissioned by the Harlem Stage to perform a concert of Waller's music, but at that same time, his wife was prodding him to try something new.
And my wife was like, Jason, you need to do something for some people to come dance. And I followed her lead and thought Fats Waller is the perfect vehicle for this kind of investigation of his sound related to dance. And so that led us all the way from that commission 3 years ago to this recording.
A lot of people might expect, well, you're a pianist, you know, you'll just do a straight piano tribute. But
right.
There's a different philosophy with this album.
Yeah, I mean, I love collaborators and collaborating. And the first person I called was the beautiful and genius Michelle Ndege Ocello. She and I really kind of put our heads together and started to look at this music. And as much as I love traditional concerts and traditional celebrations of great artists, that has not been my forte. I've always chosen to try to do something else with the form and the format.
You know, we had Michelle Ndege Ocello on the show here a few months back. Mm-hmm. We spoke to her in front of a live audience and knew that you were doing this work with her, and I asked her about working with you. Here's what she said.
My process with Jason is to love him and let him be free. I hire people to surround him. Like, I just want to be this kind of person that just creates an environment where the artists can do what they do best, you know? And that might mean just bringing the coffee.
You know? So, does that sound about right?
That is her. That is her. Oh, I love her so much. Yeah, she was amazing at that. A way of kind of giving me the bedrock to walk around on. And then to just also, as a fan, watch her manipulate these songs with, you know, such beautiful minimalism. It's a really great way to approach good music.
You know, clearly she's doing a lot more than just bringing the coffee. You listen to, you know, probably the song most associated with Fats Waller, Ain't Misbehavin'.
Ain't Misbehavin' is such an iconic American piece of music, a guy professing his love for his partner. And in reality, like Fats Waller, he says in an interview that he wrote this song while he was in alimony jail. You know, like, wow. You know, you write your hit in the jail. Wow, go ahead, Fats Waller. But in one of his recordings, the recording I have, at the very end of it, he says, for you, for you, for you, for you.
For you, for you.
And it more felt like kind of like a prayer, like a mantra to give yourself confidence and convince yourself and convince those around you with this word, these words. And I just took him uttering those words for you over and over again and made that the new landscape for us to perform the song on top of.
I'm speaking with pianist and composer Jason Moran about his new album, All Rise, a joyful elegy for Fats Waller. You know, I'd always thought that Fats Waller sounded so modern, and now I feel like I can hold this album up to people as proof.
I mean, he is modern, especially in that time frame. You have to think about African-American performers and the trajectory that they've gone. Fats Waller, with all this insane piano technique, but also this freedom with his lips to say the things that he says, you know, to think the things that he thinks. The son of a preacher, the man who likes to drink, you know, the man who finds his sorrow but expresses it through comedy. And these songs, they don't just seem funny. They don't just seem sad. You know, like there's always this duality of them. And what we try to look at is part of that duality. That probably comes mostly into light when Michelle performs Ain't Nobody's Business. It's a haunting rendition of that song, and it's quite wonderful.
If I should take the notion to jump in the ocean, ain't nobody's business if I do.
There's sadness there, but a dear friend of mine once said that whenever she needed something to give her a lift, Fats Waller was the most reliable thing in the world. There's this joy in this music that comes across in that.
Right. You know, and when we do these performances live, I have this enormous papier-mâché Fats Waller mask that I wear for the performance.
Picture of that. What's that about?
Well, you know, because people want joy, and a good mask can bring that. Because I wanted to embody Fats in a way, literally, but also like a spiritual reviving, you know. But I want Fats to know that I'm really trying to maintain and uphold his legacy with the highest honor.
Isn't wearing a mask on stage, I've seen this, it's a big mask. Doesn't that make it hard to play?
You know, this is like a Mardi Gras mask, and you actually can see through the nostrils. And there's something about being in, you're in Fats Waller's head. That's a little bit odd already. But sonically, everything changes in there. So you're in kind of like this cocoon. And also, nobody in the band can see any kind of eye cues from you. There's no cues being given unless they're by hand, you know. But it's a different space that you set up inside there. And I've actually found myself psychologically like retreating into the mask and wearing it more and more. Because it was almost, I felt like a way of hiding even more and more. And I'm still kind of working through this issue with the mask.
I think it's when you start wearing it when you're not on stage. That's when you need to maybe get a professional to help you out. That's pianist Jason Moran. His new album is All Rise, a joyful elegy for Fats Waller. That comes out on Tuesday, but until then, you can sample every track at our exclusive First Listen. That's at nprmusic.org. Jason Moran, I've so enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you're not familiar with a comedy of Tim and Eric, that's Tim Heidecker and Eric Wareheim, well, it's pretty hard to describe. They alternate between deadpan and total Dada-esque absurdity. They like to focus on the existential nausea of everyday interactions and take a sledgehammer to consumer culture. Their latest series is called Tim and Eric's Bedtime Stories. They're short, extremely disturbing vignettes in the style of The Twilight Zone. It premieres this Thursday on Adult Swim, and Tim and Eric join me right here at NPR West. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I am so delighted with your success because I've been a fan since Tom Goes to the Mayor, since your first Adult Swim show. But at the same time, I'm shocked at your success.
What success?
Yeah.
Well, you've had a bunch of series now.
Yes.
You've done commercial work. You're getting to do kind of like the stuff you want, right?
Yeah, I mean, just this year we celebrated our 20th anniversary of friendship. And aww. I was looking at some old videos of stuff that we did in college when we first met, and it's almost identical to what we're doing right now for movies and commercials.
It's definitely not mainstream, but luckily there's places like Adult Swim and the internet now where you can kind of have your own niche, and we're not really looking to appeal to a large swath of people, you know.
And that's how Tom Goes to the Mayor started, right? You did that on the web first?
Yeah, we did it at home. We didn't have enough money or the skills to actually make a live-action TV show, so Tim had this idea to make this word filtered cartoon with our voices.
We tried to make a cartoon and circumvent the actual cartoonist.
How did you get this bizarre thing on the air?
We sort of thought, well, why don't we send our tapes to the people we like and see what they think we should do? And we sent one to Bob Odenkirk from Mr. Show and Breaking Bad now to get his attention. We included a invoice for the DVD that we sent.
You sent him a bill?
Yeah. It was an unsolicited package, and we put our own headshots in there, and we charged him like $150 for the whole thing.
So we expect to receive this. He called me and was like, who are you? What is this? I like this. And that sort of just opened the door.
You moved on from that to another Adult Swim show, Tim and Eric's awesome show, Great Job. A lot of the humor in that is from the low tech, the bad editing, and these moments of just delicious awkwardness.
Basically mimicking what we loved back in Philly, which is people on cable access, people that almost shouldn't be on camera, you know, that had that true awkwardness.
You could, try to create the authenticity that makes you feel like maybe this really is one of those, you know, local car commercials or something.
This is from the universe. You two are playing scientists in a kind of like a Discovery Channel public broadcast.
Kind of a rip off the original Carl Sagan.
Yeah, you have black sweaters.
Mm-hmm. When I was a child, there was thought to be 9 planets. But there are now 90 planets.
You know, the ultimate fate of the universe is so dark and mysterious that it generates butterflies in my stomach, and that goes to tickles in my spine, and that creates goose pimples, and then that penetrates my mind, and then the whole Big Bang explosion.
Yeah, what I heard listening to that in my own voice was how close I was to losing it, to cracking up in the delivery of that. I'm trying to make Eric laugh and the cameraman laugh, and he's trying to make me laugh when he's on camera, and that's always at the heart of everything we do, and that's really the end of the conversation.
I'm talking with Tim Heidecker and Eric Wareheim, the minds behind Tim and Eric Awesome Show, Great Job, and now Tim and Eric's Bedtime Stories, which premieres this Thursday on Adult Swim. So let's talk about the new show, Tim and Eric's Bedtime Stories. Give me the Hollywood pitch.
We wanted to tell little short stories that have a darker edge, kind of a nightmarish quality to them, but still funny and absurd and sort of go the opposite direction of the lo-fi aesthetic that we've kind of established and make something that looks pretty and big budge looking.
Let's get a little taste of that. This is from the first episode where you two are playing neighbors who are meeting for the first time. It turns dark.
I tell you what would make you a big hit with the dudes is get some key lime pie, a la mode. I'm talking about ice cream on the side.
Right.
And I've got to have a bite of my homemade ziti. I'm just going to warm her up. She's been in the freeze. So why don't you come by around 8 o'clock, all right?
Actually, I have plans with the wife and kids, so. But a rain check for sure.
All right. Sounds good. See you at 8.
No, actually, I'm not going to come over tonight. I'm going to spend some time with the kids.
I'll see you at 8 o'clock.
So Eric, your character does not meet up with him, and things turn much darker from there.
After listening to that, I feel like 90% of my interactions with other humans are like that. You know, like I
did
feel
you
like,
hear what I was saying?
Yeah,
did you
I feel like most of life is a nightmare. You know, like you have a couple friends and a couple beautiful moments, but everything else, and this show kind of embraces those moments of like, I cannot believe that this is really happening. You know.
Now, I've only seen the first two episodes, but this kind of feels like it's just dark.
Yeah. I mean, we're trying to get back to that, really, that a lot of entertainment is very passive and it's very sort of something you could have on in the background or that's sort of just fine. And we're trying to do something that's going to shake things up a little bit.
What's it going to mean if your style of humor becomes really mainstream?
The end times.
that there's going to be something else that comes along that makes it feel really lame.
I'm really hoping for this new generation of comedy that's just going to blow us away. The idea of laughing is over, and that's where bedtime stories comes in.
Yeah, you know? All comedy, got, like, you know, Louis C.K., and, you know, we're all like, we're tired of trying to make people laugh with our humor. We want to make people cry.
Yeah.
That's Eric Wareheim, along with Tim Heidecker. They are Tim and Eric. Gentlemen, thanks. It's been a blast speaking with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Awesome.
The Brazilian composer and bandleader, Sergio Mendes, has a new album of collaborations out this week. It's called Magic.
I see the wonder in your eyes. Let the rhythm hypnotize. Let it take your mind away.
That's a song with John Legend called Don't Say Goodbye. Sergio Mendes stopped by our studios here at NPR West to talk about his early career as part of our series, My Big Break.
I call it the magic of the encounter, the magic of encountering people that help me, that support me. My life has been very much a succession of those moments, and I feel very good and very humble about that. I was born in a city called Niterói, which is across the bay from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. My childhood was on the beach, like a lot of other kids, playing soccer, and I started learning classical music, Chopin, Beethoven, Mozart. And I had a wonderful teacher. And so that's my beginning with the music and piano and classical music. At about 12 years old, for the first time, I heard a jazz record. A friend of mine had the Dave Brubeck record. And I remember it was a song, Take Five. For me, that was like, I would say, one of the incredible moments of my life, because when I heard that, I had no idea about jazz or anything. So the whole world of jazz for me was like, wow, what is that? The freedom of improvisation. I'm very curious, and I love to try new things. So the idea that you could improvise, and you have under fantastic harmonies, chords. I mean, for me, that was magical. Now I'm already like 17, 18. I'm playing in nightclubs in Rio de Janeiro. Those are the days of the bossa nova now. So in 1962, November, they had a bossa nova concert at Carnegie Hall. I brought my band. We played at Carnegie Hall. It was João Gilberto, Jobim, Stan Getz, Dizzy Gillespie, a lot of my idols. And for me at 19 or 20 years old to come to America was like, wow. So after Carnegie Hall, I went back to Brazil. Then finally decided to come to America again in 1964. Came to Los Angeles. I had a friend of mine, his name was Tom Hormel and Jordi Hormel, and they love Brazilian music. And they said, Sergio, can you use our place to rehearse whatever you want to do? People from record companies, they used to come to Hormel's studio to hear us. So we'd play three, four, five songs, and a lot of record companies came in. No answer, nothing, you know, just, oh, thank you, you guys sound great, bye. So we kept rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing. So one day, walk in a couple of guys, and they were Jerry Moss and Herb Alpert, A and M. And they introduced themselves, and they heard a couple of songs. And he said to me, he said, I really like your sound. I'd like to sign you with our record company. And I said, wow, really? You know, great, here we go. We did the first record, you know. Herb Alpert presents Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66. The song Mais Que Nada went to the top of the charts. It was the first time that the song in Portuguese was a hit in America and all over the world. And I bought my first car, a Pontiac Le Mans. You remember that? 1966. Gray. that's the song that gave me my first big break, and I still love playing it. I haven't never got tired of it.
The new album from Sergio Mendes is called Magic, and we want to hear about your big break, even if you haven't played Carnegie Hall. Send us an email at mybigbreak@npr.org. Writer James Ellroy has been capturing a gritty, film noirish Los Angeles for decades now, with novels like The Black Dahlia and L.A. Confidential. He's just released the first installment in a new L.A. crime quartet, a 700-page epic called Perfidia. It follows many of the same characters from those previous novels, and it focuses around the L.A. police response to a horrific murder of a Japanese-American family the day before the attack on Pearl Harbor. James Ellroy's life reads like a James Ellroy novel. He was just 10 when his mother was murdered in East Los Angeles, a case that was never solved. Ellroy still lives here in L.A., so he invited us to lunch.
James Ellroy, thank you for joining us.
Arun, it's good to be here.
We're at the Pacific Dining Car, a relic of a steakhouse near downtown L.A. It's his favorite restaurant.
I've been here at least 16 trillion times. They've made films about me here. I met my beloved second ex-wife, the novelist Helen Knud, in that booth I'm pointing to. We had our divorce party here, so it's a place with some history.
What do you like about it?
I like steak. I like that it's been here since 1921. I like that it's quiet and comfortable and cool on what bodes as the hottest day of the year.
Are you ready to order?
For me, the crab cakes. And Ellroy?
Brother, how about a chicken Caesar with extra anchovies?
We start out talking about Los Angeles.
My relationship to Los Angeles is entirely autobiographical. I was born two blocks from here in 1948. So my parents hatched me in the film noir epicenter at the height of the film noir era, and my parents were right out of film noir. In my book, My Dark Places, about my mother's murder, I said they were a great-looking, my mother and dad, cheap couple, rather like Robert Mitchum and Jane Russell in Macau. So where else are they going to go? L.A. They were both too good-looking to live. They had to have me. So I survived to tell you the story of L.A., way back when.
There's a deliciousness to the detail in this book. I mean, I find myself wanting to put addresses into Google Maps and look them up. When you're doing the research for the historical detail, like, for instance, looking into the reaction in Los Angeles after the bombing in Pearl Harbor or the Japanese internment, how do you go about that? How do you sit down and figure out how to recreate that world, that Los Angeles of that time?
It's in my blood. I'm a historical novelist at my heart, and I'm 66 years old. I realize I don't look it. And I've lived here in L.A. most of my life. It's where I come when women divorce me. One of the first things I noted when putting the notes together for Perfidia was proximity. Here's little Tokyo, the chief Japanese enclave of the era. It adjoins Chinatown. You go a few blocks west, you have the LAPD Central Station and the crime lab on the third floor. You cut back northeast, and there's the LAPD Detective Bureau. You get on the first freeway in LA, the Arroyo Seco, and it's a straight shot north to the scene of the Watanabe murder case. The Japanese family killed the day before Pearl Harbor. It's a hotbed of geopolitical tension, war fever, racial enmity, and flat-out race hate. You can go get your Peking duck and talk anti-Japanese stuff at Uncle Ace Kwan's and cut back on foot two blocks, and you're in the middle of the police rousts in Little Tokyo. So that is what gave this book, this realization of mine, it's combustible, it's all localized. This is, in a weird way, both sprawling L.A. and small-town L.A. at the same time.
Halfway through my conversation with novelist James Ellroy, our food arrives, and I ask him what about historical fiction attracts him so much.
I've always been in awe of history, and there's an anecdote that serves to explain it. When I was 8 years old in 1956, the pervasiveness, the imaginative pervasiveness of World War II was staggering to me. I believed that it was still going on. I said something that alerted my mother to this misconception, and she explained to me, "No, Sonny, the war ended in 1945, 3 years before you were born." And I had a very hard time believing it. I've always been more to recent American history, but way, way back during my youth. If a historical epoch, its big characters, its circumstances, its geopolitical stakes, its human infrastructure speaks to me, I know it's time to write a novel about it.
So what was it about the, well, particularly the beginning of the U.S. involvement in World War II and the Japanese internment that caught your imagination?
I wanted to live World War II in the American home front with characters I had already created, missed, frankly, and dearly loved.
Do you feel like these are characters external to you, or they're part of you?
They're entirely part of me. The laborious process that I engage of writing by hand with pen on white notebook paper, being computer illiterate, existing outside the digital world, and I've written all 19 of my books in this manner, allows me to sustain concentration, I've come to believe, more deeply, and allows me to live more richly in the text as I compose it.
So you live without a computer, without the internet, all that
I have an assistant. She has a cell phone. She has a computer. She types my books. And I submit handwritten pages to her. I have a fax machine, too.
What about other media? Are you watching the news, listening to the news? What do you take in? What's your media diet?
I have a music room and a classical CD collection and a great stereo system. Aside from that, I will watch the occasional crime TV show at a friend's place. I have no television. I have no VCR. I don't watch the news. I don't listen to the radio or read newspapers. I largely ignore the world today. I live almost completely and very happily within my imagination. I'm like, and God will forgive me for this comparison, Beethoven at his desk with a quill pen and his piano over here that he taps out notes on, although I can't play the piano. I like going back to another time and getting lost in it and living as immediately as I can the lives of a tormented Japanese criminologist who was in the direst of straits, the month of December 1941, Kay Lake, William H. Parker, and Dudley Smith.
James Ellroy, it's been a blast speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Arun, it was a deep down, dirty, lasciviously L.A. blast.
The novelist James Ellroy. His newest novel, Perfidia, is out now. And by the way, those crab cakes were delicious. And for the week ending September 14th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, and Denise Guerra. Our intern is Chloe Persinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leo Dell'Aquila and Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.